new kind of warfare was launched, one not known before, the Color Revolutions.
An NGO is a non-governmental organization. Now, many NGOs are quite legitimate. They represent good causes. Maybe they help people in a country feed or deal with water problems or deal with various kinds of social problems. But there are some NGOs that have become funded by government entities and serve more the purpose of that government rather than trying to serve the people that they are ostensibly working for. One thing we saw in the 1980s, at that point, the Central Intelligence Agency had been largely discredited because of scandals that had been exposed in the 1970s.
November 30th of 2013 became the first turning point of Euromaidan and one of its most reported and mysterious events. Incidentally, one such organization, Hromadske TV, received generous donations from the Dutch and U.S. embassies, as well as from the Renaissance Foundation, an NGO founded by George Soros.
I set up a foundation in Ukraine before Ukraine became independent of Russia. And the foundation has been functioning ever since. And it played an important part in events now.
Any good director will tell you that tempo and rhythm are the most essential components to hold an audience's attention. It can also be called a method of betrayal when the allies and followers are relentlessly thrown into the revolutionary flame. The idea is simple. When the preparation work is done, the trigger just needs to be pulled to set the machine into full motion. The murder of politician Rafik Hariri led to the Cedar Revolution. Looking back at the mysterious poisoning of Viktor Yushchenko right before the Orange Revolution of 2004, we see now that he became a sacred victim himself. Most political analysts believe the compassion of the Ukrainian people at that moment tilted the scales, giving him the presidency. Like in 2004 during the Orange Revolution, international leaders felt it necessary to intervene and bring both sides to the negotiating table.
Приехали три министра иностранных дел европейских стран в Киев.
Laurent Fabius, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, Radoslav Sikorsky.
The Ukrainian president and the leaders of the anti-government protests there have agreed on a truce.
The truce was to give talks between President Yanukovych and the opposition a chance.
Just like in 2004, the opposition, or at least its radical faction, the Right Sector, headed by Dmitry Yarosh, had no intention on fulfilling its part of the bargain.
The opposition leaders left saying they may have found a way to end the bloodshed, but they wanted to take the conclusions from their meeting to the people.
It was soon apparent that the people were not happy.
At the same time, Kiev was saying its last goodbyes to the victims of the massacre. It was also welcoming those who came to power at their cost.
Ukraine's parliament has voted for the new speaker of the assembly to become interim president. Alexander Turchynov called on lawmakers to form an interim government by Tuesday. These latest developments follow the dismissal of President Viktor Yanukovych on Saturday.
And they removed Yanukovych, not following the constitutional procedures for impeachment.
The parliament of Ukraine consists of 450 deputies. The constitution of Ukraine requires at least a three-fourths majority to vote. In other words, 338 votes in favor of the impeachment. But only 328 deputies voted yes.
The U.S. State Department almost immediately said this was a legitimate government, and that was part of this effort to get regime change. Instead of trying to find some way to revive the February 21st agreement, where maybe you could bring back Yanukovych in some titular way, that became not a possibility anymore. Then you had eastern Ukraine resisting, you had Crimea wanting to break away, and things rapidly escalated.
Voters will decide Sunday whether they'll leave Ukraine and join Russia.
The campaign with the slogan, "Together with Russia," has the backing of Moscow.
Crimean authorities, sensing the mood of the populace, fully supported Viktor Yanukovych's decision to postpone the 2013 European Union Association deal and side deeper ties to Russia. As the events in Kiev took their course, Crimean authorities issued a declaration, putting into words the fears of its people. "Based on the will of the Crimeans who elected us, we declare that we will not give Crimea to extremists and neo-Nazis seeking to seize power in Ukraine at the cost of the blood of the country and its citizens." After the regime change in Kiev, rumors began spreading in Crimea that the new authorities would be merciless to those that opposed them.
Slava Ukraini!
This led to the pro-Russian demonstrations rejecting the new government in Kiev. On February 27th, the government buildings in the capital of Crimea were seized by pro-Russian protesters. The current Crimean government was dismissed, and the new leader, Sergei Aksyonov, was assigned as the leader of the Crimean Autonomous Republic. On March 16th, the Crimean referendum was held, and the people voted to leave Ukraine and enter the Russian Federation.
The situation in Crimea is being presented as a Russian invasion. And again, nobody who looks at this seriously and looks at the poll numbers, some of the poll numbers done by the U.S. government agencies themselves, showing that the people of Crimea preferred being part of Russia. In the U.S. news media, it has all been presented as the Russians invaded, they then staged a sham election with people with guns at their backs. Somehow they faked the ballot boxes to get 96% approval for rejoining Russia.
The idea of a referendum in Crimea is just quite simply unconstitutional.
It does raise questions on whether this vote really is free and fair, especially given the heavy military presence in Crimea right now, Errol.
So that's how it's been sold to the American people. The reality is very different.
The atmosphere here certainly is electric. Thousands of people who've gathered in the capital Crimean city of Simferopol, all of this following a referendum held last Sunday in which the majority of people here overwhelmingly voted in support of being reunited with Russia.
As long ago as 1804, Sevastopol's naval base became the main military port of the Russian Empire on the Black Sea. During the Second World War, the heroic defense of Sevastopol lasted almost a year and took hundreds of thousands of lives. Therefore, the naval base in Crimea has a legacy of historical pride for the Russian Black Sea Fleet, as well as being of huge strategic importance.
Those of us alive back then remember when there were Soviet missiles put into Cuba, how frightened Americans were and how angry, and how we almost went to a nuclear confrontation over having weapons of that kind of destruction placed that close to the United States.
If the United States considers Cuba to be in its backyard, then Crimea lays at Russia's doorstep. In early spring of 2014, eastern Ukraine was also buzzing with protests against the new authorities in Kiev. This region, with the population close to Russia geographically and culturally, feared that the ultra-right leanings of the newly formed government would bring neo-nationalism to their lands. And they had their reasons. The status of the Russian language in Ukraine has been a stumbling block for many years.
Implementing Russian as a second state language was one of the main campaign promises of President Viktor Yanukovych.
In 2012, the Yanukovych government passed a law making it the second official language in the southern and eastern parts of Ukraine, the areas where the Russian-speaking population makes up a majority. Ukrainian nationalist groups initiated massive protests opposing the law. An observing viewer might see some familiar faces there. On February 23, 2014, the very next day after the regime change, the new government voted for an annulment of the official status of the Russian language And even though later this decision was vetoed by the acting president, Alexander Turchynov, it still sent a message, and a powerful one. This alarmed the Russian-speaking cities of eastern Ukraine, and people took to the streets to show their disagreement. In response, pro-Maidan groups conducted their own demonstrations. When the two parties would meet, it was always tense, and eventually it led to tragedy. One person died and over 50 people were wounded in clashes during a pro-Russian march protesting the new government in Kiev. On April 6th, the Crimean scenario began repeating in eastern Ukraine, where protesters seized government buildings. And the next day, April 7th, they proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic. Kiev replied by announcing the beginning of an anti-terrorist operation in eastern Ukraine. By that time, the international media was screaming about a Russian invasion in Ukraine.
Russia could now be on the verge of invading Ukraine.
But strong words stayed only in the media. The Ukrainian authorities never announced a warlike situation. Why? IMF cannot give money to countries engaged in ongoing war, Petro Poroshenko. Too much money was already invested in Ukraine to stop halfway.
We've invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals that will ensure a secure and prosperous and democratic Ukraine.
Obviously, the funds had to keep coming, and the conflict had to keep going. Getting more and more bloody and deadly. As parties from both sides were using more sophisticated and lethal weapons. The world seemed too busy welcoming this new democracy in Kiev to notice what was being done as it spread its wings over the country. Many in southern Ukraine had been viewing the revolution with concern. And an anti-Maidan movement formed in the city of Odessa in early January 2014. The protesters set up their camp in front of the Trade Union House, a building which would soon become a monument to a massacre of its own. It's difficult to overestimate the importance of Odessa. It is strategically located on the Black Sea, and it's Ukraine's largest seaport. It's not surprising that Ukraine's new authorities were watching the situation unfolding there with growing alarm. More and more of Odessa's people were joining the anti-Maidan movement at the same time as events in eastern Ukraine were heating up. The new Ukrainian government didn't have the power to wage war on too many fronts. If Odessa were to join the growing uprising in the eastern regions, it would seriously complicate the situation. This rebellion had to be extinguished immediately and at any cost, and that cost was high. On May 2, 2014, soccer fans flocked to the center of Odessa City for the Ukrainian championship match. Surprisingly, a great number of these fans who descended into Odessa just the night before also turned out to be fighters from the Maidan self-defense units, along with members of radical organizations from all parts of Ukraine. These fans, masked, armed, and shouting nationalist mottos, began disturbances in the center of the city as they marched to the anti-Maidan tent encampment, where they attacked. The anti-Maidan protesters sought shelter in the Trade Union House, but it was a trap. Maidan supporters started throwing Molotov cocktails into the building until it was engulfed in flames. People burned to death inside, or, trying to escape, jumped from the windows. Although a fire station was less than a mile away, it took almost half an hour for firefighters to arrive. When they finally did, the damage had been done. But here's an intriguing fact. Just a few days before those dreadful events, a messenger from Maidan, Andriy Peruby, made a visit to Odessa. It's an interesting coincidence that some of the people he met with in Odessa were seen at the scene that fateful day. But not everyone was mourning. On the popular political talk show, Schuster Live, the news about the people burnt alive in Odessa was welcomed with a long round of applause. On its Facebook page, the Right Sector announced the events of May 2nd, a proud moment in national history. An official investigation into this sad event has been going on now for nearly 2 years, and it's yet to reach a conclusion. But it seems the experts had all the information they needed from the very beginning. It looks like Odessa really is a very important piece of real estate, as it was honored with a very special new governor appointed on May 30th of 2015. Mikhail Saakashvili, an old friend of the United States and born and raised in Ukraine's neighboring country, Georgia.
A little hoedown there in Georgia.
A quick look at his biography gives one an understanding that he's been groomed for a special mission. Mr. Saakashvili received a U.S. State Department scholarship, and he worked for a New York law firm which represented the organization Kamara, a group that appeared earlier when we learned about the color revolutions.
We are dealing with democratic, bloodless revolution.
This is the Revolution of Roses. And this is Mikhail Saakashvili with Kamara, busy overthrowing the legitimately elected president, Eduard Shevardnadze. Soon after the Rose Revolution blossomed fully, Georgia announced its intentions to join NATO and plant fresh NATO military bases in the fertile soil right on Russia's border.
Never ever we will give our freedom and independence. Never ever will give any piece of our territory.
Saakashvili's mission was accomplished. At least with his friends and NATO. The Georgian populace wasn't quite as happy, though. In 2007, they took to the streets to voice discontent. And Mr. Saakashvili responded with force. The people's discontent grew. Saakashvili's party lost parliamentary elections, and the opposition took control.
He said, "This means that the parliamentary majority should set up a new government and me as the president, according to our constitution."
Mikhail decided not to wait for the results of the president's election and fled the country in October 2013. In 2014, Saakashvili refused summons to appear in court as a witness in several criminal cases. Later that same year, he was accused of misuse of power and embezzlement. Saakashvili wound up in the U.S., and soon his friends in Washington found him a new assignment. Mikhail actively supported Maidan, and very soon was rewarded with a high position in the new Ukrainian government. First as the president's counselor, and then as the governor of Odessa. The day before taking this position, he renounced his citizenship to Georgia, the country of his birth, and became a Ukrainian citizen. As they say, the battle is worth the blood, both literally and figuratively. Jeffrey Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, paid a visit to Saakashvili just a month after he took office in Odessa.
But as long as the Oblast administration is delivering results on Ukraine, you are going to see a steady flow of embassy and Washington visitors coming here.
The meeting was fruitful, and Jeffrey, generous. No matter how well Saakashvili's job goes, it looks like he shouldn't be worried about his own finances. On his Facebook page, he posted an official document showing that the new governor of Odessa gets a pretty penny from Washington, almost $200,000 a year. For comparison, the governor of Maine gets $70,000 a year. So if Odessa became a new U.S. state, it would be at the top of the list. Mr. Saakashvili should feel right at home in his newly adopted country. He is best of friends with fellow color revolutionary leader Viktor Yushchenko, who's the godfather of his son. A war, once launched, doesn't choose its victims.
We are just learning at this hour that Malaysian Airlines has now confirmed that it has lost contact with one of its planes.
The plane was indeed shot down by a missile while flying at a high altitude over eastern Ukraine near the Russian border.
298 revised number of souls on board, all feared dead.
It was a murder. It was a crime. There's been this odd nonchalance about pursuing the answers. There was a report, a very limited report, put out a few months after the event, But since then, they said the next report will be on the first anniversary of the event. But you deal with a criminal investigation before it becomes a cold case. So there's been this curious element of why is there not greater pressure from both the media and the Western governments to answer these questions.
But even without any answers, the fingers were pointed immediately.
That's not an accident. That is happening because of Russian support. Evidence indicates that the plane was shot down by a surface-to-air missile that was launched from an area that is controlled by Russian-backed separatists inside of Ukraine.
The Malaysian Boeing wasn't the first plane to play a significant part in American-Russian relationships. On September 1, 1983, Korean Airlines Flight 007 from New York to Seoul via Anchorage was shot down by a Soviet interceptor aircraft over the territory of the USSR in the Sea of Japan.
There was absolutely no justification, either legal or moral, for what the Soviets did.
The tragedy of the Korean Boeing was considered a perfect occasion to demonstrate the NATO military power within dangerous proximity to the Soviets. On November 2, 1983, NATO launched Able Archer, a 10-day command post exercise simulating a conflict escalation, culminating in a nuclear attack. It was followed by placing Pershing II nuclear missiles in Europe. What Reagan didn't take into consideration was the paranoid overreaction of the Soviets. A recently declassified U.S. intelligence report shows that for the first time since the Cuban Missile Crisis, the world was that close to nuclear war. Just like in 1983, the Malaysian Boeing crash was leveraged against the enemy. A new wave of sanctions hit Russia immediately after the tragedy.
The United States is imposing new sanctions in key sectors of the Russian economy.
Almost a year and 3 months later, the Dutch Safety Board published a report.
Ladies and gentlemen, flight MH17 crashed because of a 9N314M warhead detonated outside the aeroplane above the left side of the cockpit.
The report didn't blame any specific group or person and estimated a very wide area of 320 kilometers as a zone from which the missile was fired. At the same time, the Russian producer of Buk missiles, Almazante, conducted its own independent investigation. During the experiment, they blew up a retired airliner with a Buk missile and came to the conclusion that the Malaysian plane was brought down by the older type of missiles, not used by Russia anymore, but still in the possession of Ukraine. The company claims that the missile was launched from the territory controlled by the Ukrainian military. One would expect that these controversial results would again stir up public interest in the investigation, but the tragedy of Malaysian flight MH17 had already played its role in the big geopolitical game. Therefore, it was soon forgotten. The goal was achieved. After the third wave of sanctions hit Russia, the tensions between the two countries skyrocketed. So the question presents itself: are we truly witnessing the beginning of Cold War 2.0? And if so, what are our chances to survive it this time? In 1947, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists introduced the Doomsday Clock. It represents a countdown to global nuclear annihilation. In 1953, during the height of the Cold War, it came its closest to midnight as the superpowers were creating massive nuclear arsenals.
This is the story of America's ever-expanding atomic weapons program.
As the world began to grasp the insane danger of nuclear warfare and took measures to control the arms race, the situation steadily improved. In 1991, the Doomsday Clock was at its furthest from midnight, 17 minutes. That time of hope was short-lived, though, as the world has become more and more unstable. But in 2015, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists moved the clock to just 3 minutes to midnight.
Today, unchecked climate change and a nuclear arms race resulting from modernization of huge arsenals pose extraordinary and undeniable threats to the continued existence of humanity.
The United States and Russia have embarked on massive programs to modernize their nuclear arsenals, undermining existing nuclear weapons treaties. The clock ticks now at just 3 minutes to midnight, because international leaders are failing to perform their most important duty, ensuring and preserving the health and vitality of human civilization.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, children of temporary visa holders who can't gain permanent residency in the U.S. are one of several groups urging the Biden administration to act on an immigration overhaul. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Aishwarya Kavi. The piece is titled, They Grew Up Legally in the U.S., but can't stay after they turn 21. In 2011, after 5 years of working and living with his family in the United States on a temporary visa, Bharathi Mohan Ganesan submitted green card applications for his wife, his 5-year-old daughter, and his 11-year-old son. Mr. Ganesan, who was born in India and has also lived in Singapore and Australia, was nervous about when his wife and children might gain permanent residency of the United States. He knew the waiting list was specially long for Indians on his kind of visa, an H-1B, which allows American companies to employ skilled foreign workers. Because of chronic backlogs, it can take years to process those on work visas who apply for permanent residency. Last year, a decade after he applied, Mr. Ganesan, his wife and his daughter received their green cards. But his son had turned 21 and missed the cutoff by a matter of few months, leaving him scrambling for a visa that would allow him to stay in the United States. Mr. Ganesan's son is among more than 200,000 children who grew up in the United States under the protection of their parents' temporary visas, which can be renewed indefinitely. But the children risk losing their legal status when they turn 21. Unable to become permanent residents of the United States because of the backlogs, or because they were never eligible in the first place, they must obtain a different visa, remain in the United States without legal status, or leave the country entirely. According to the Cato Institute, more than 10,000 children aged out of green card eligibility each year. Untold numbers eventually depart the United States, often leaving their families behind. These young people do not qualify for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA program, created by executive action during the Obama administration. The DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, protects from deportation about 650,000 youths, or DREAMers, who were brought into the United States and have remained without legal status. Because the program requires applicants to be undocumented, it does not offer those with legal status a way to stay in the United States. A comprehensive immigration overhaul is highly unlikely to pass a deadlocked Congress in a midterm election year. The Biden administration has been under increasing pressure as a Trump-era public health order known as Title 42 is said to be lifted in late May, a move that is expected to create a surge of migration across the southwestern border of the United States. A bipartisan group of senators restarted immigration discussions on Thursday, 28th of April, to try to identify standalone proposals that would have the support of both political parties. When asked on Thursday, 28th of April, whether the Biden administration, which is updating the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, the DACA program, was considering extending protections to documented youth, Alejandro Mayorkas, the Homeland Security Secretary, told the House Judiciary Committee that the department did not plan to do so. Its focus was to fortify the existing DACA program and shift responsibility for documented youths to Congress, he said, adding that their situation spoke to the imperative to pass immigration reform. In interviews, more than a dozen people who lived in the United States on temporary visas from a young age described their struggles with anxiety and the financial burden of navigating how to remain in the country they considered home. They are urging the Biden administration, if it will not provide a path to citizenship, to offer a way for them to legally remain in the country. Mr. Ganesan's son, Niranjan Bharathimohan, is able to stay in the United States until this November only because immigration officials extended his dependent visa. Mr. Bharathimohan, a student at the University of Texas at Dallas, will have to go to Singapore, where he was born, to apply for a student visa that will allow him to return to the United States and finish his degree. His application might be rejected since he previously tried for a green card. He has shown an intent to immigrate to the United States, which is not allowed. Applicants may be asked to show that they intend to leave the country after completing their courses. Mr. Bharathimohan faces the prospect of being stuck in Singapore, where he has no family and no roots. How is he going to manage alone? Mr. Ganesan said. I was really devastated that just because of my country of birth, my son's opportunities are very limited in the United States. While there are protections to keep families together when parents move to the United States on temporary work visas, those end when children turn 21. Because they are no longer considered part of the family unit. I don't think people who originally wrote the laws foresaw a situation where children brought here on visas would be raised and educated here, but not have a clear opportunity to stay and become American citizens, said Dip Patel, the founder of Improve the Dream, an organization that campaigns for a path to citizenship for those children. Dip Patel added, delay in taking action will not only lead to tearing more families apart, but also continue the immense emotional turmoil faced by thousands of families. At a Senate hearing in March, Senator Richard Durbin, Democrat of Illinois and the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Senator John Cornyn of Texas, the top Republican on the panel's Immigration Subcommittee, vowed to work on legislation to help people who had grown up in the United States without a clear path to U.S. citizenship. Muzaffar Chishti, the director of the Migration Policy Institute at the New York University School of Law, described the issue as one of many in a system that has not been truly updated since the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952, which established the pathways for legal immigration to the United States that are still in place. Short of a legislative overhaul of the system, Improve the Dream, the advocacy group, has worked to increase awareness of the issue and is urging the Biden administration to make changes. But children of non-immigrant visa holders have criticized the Biden administration for being too slow or unwilling to take action on proposed changes, such as the expansion of the DACA program to include documented youth. Among the proposals is one that would modify how U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services determines whether an applicant qualifies for a green card, allowing more children and minors to remain eligible as they near the age of 21. Another would classify applicants as children beyond their 21st birthday to keep them in line for a green card, which is the policy for those who are refugees or asylum seekers or are sponsored by relatives who are U.S. citizens. Matthew Burke, a spokesman for the Immigration Agency, said the Department of Homeland Security was keenly aware of the challenges for documented youth in the United States and was exploring legal methods to provide immigration relief to this population where possible.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Going to talk about the rules and jurisprudential status of hijab according to Ayatollah Khamenei in this episode and hopefully in the upcoming episodes consecutively. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Law on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, host in this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the rules of hijab according to Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. And we've started a series of episodes on this issue. And I'm going to ask you, Sheikh Javid, this question. You know, it happens a lot in social gatherings, such as, for example, a wedding party.
Yeah.
All right. That, you know, some girls or women are not wearing proper dress, for example, because it's a wedding. And then some of the, you know, photos and pictures are taken of those girls and women, be it the very groom, bridegroom, all right, or the bride and some other women who are, for example, participating in those events, social events. And then these pictures are like spreading from here, from this place or from this individual or person or their phones to others, right?
Yes.
So, you know, should these girls or women who are concerned about their pictures, for example,
yes,
ask their friends and family to destroy the pictures, to delete them from the phones or not?
Yes, such incidents do happen with girls who did not used to wear hijab and you know, they were somehow careless about wearing hijab.
Yes.
So then they change their mind about it and start wearing hijab, and then they start regretting their past actions and say, "Oh, I have so many pictures with so many people, you know,
yes,
what should I do?"
No, even if it happens like to these women and girls who are in a women-only gathering,
yes,
and they are not to blame because these pictures are like taken, but they are not supposed to be out, but they are out now.
You're right. You know, according to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, if the keeping of these pictures by the other people entail no vile effect or no negative consequences, you know, and you do not have any role in giving these pictures to those people.
Right.
You know? These pictures were sometimes taken by others without you giving your consent, you know, and it does happen like that. So, and of course, if it is difficult for you to collect those pictures or to delete them or to, you know, to get those pictures back from your friends or relatives, then you're not to blame. You don't have any obligation. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
So you have no duty with regards to destroying those pictures because you can't do it. Some of your pictures are posted on the websites. You don't have, for example, the username or the password to remove those pictures, and they are now circulating here and there. People see them. You're not to blame in that case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Sheikh Javid, you know, sometimes it happens to people that they love or like some people who are non-mahram. For example, they are the martyrs of family or friends, and some of them religious authorities even, right? And they have their pictures because they follow them and, you know, they like them, they love them, and they sometimes even kiss their pictures. Is it permissible to do so
for the girls? The rules which apply to a physical person or to someone, you know, you are in touch with do not apply to their pictures, mm-hmm. okay? For example, you can kiss for Imam Khomeini's picture, and it is not, you know, whether you are a man or a woman, you know, it does not make any difference. And of course, there are girls. I have seen myself kissing the pictures of the martyrs, mm-hmm. and they don't have any lustful intention, you know.
Yes,
they don't kiss those pictures to drive some kind of pleasure, you know. So it's out of love or respect that they kiss those pictures, mm-hmm. and there is no objection to those women okay. kissing the pictures of Imam Khomeini or those of the martyrs.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about Ayatollah Khamenei's views on the laws of hijab or hijab-related issues with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, you know, lots of movies today, in fact, show semi-naked or even naked women to their audience. Is it permissible to look at those pictures or movies unknown to us, you know?
Well, generally speaking, watching films and looking at pictures do not have the same ruling of the non-mahrams themselves, you know, the people themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So you are looking at pictures of naked or partially naked girls. It's quite different from watching the people themselves
mm-hmm. Live
out there live, for example. Mm-hmm. So there's, according to Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, there's no objection as per the Islamic Sharia to see them, as provided that, you know, that's the condition we must take into consideration, provided that there's no lustful intention, there's no evil intention, and one does not see them with the intention of driving pleasure, you know, pleasure. And if there's no such bad result or there's no such intention, there's no objection, and seeing them, you know, we must differentiate between seeing something and watching something with lustful intention. Sometimes out of, you know, pure and intention and accident, you just see them, okay, there's no objection. But sometimes, you know, you watch naked pictures, and the naked pictures, it's not within in your control. You just end up, you know, getting excited. And this is the natural result of seeing obscene pictures, you know. And it's always intertwined with looking with some kind of sexual urge, you know, urge.
Yes.
So, if that is the case, of course, if it leads to some kind of sexual excitement, then it's not permissible to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if a person is sure that it leads to kind of some kind of discharge or emission or ejaculation, obviously it's not permissible.
Okay. Chef Javid, is it permissible for a woman, for example, in wedding parties to take some pictures of herself, all right?
Yes.
Without the permission of her husband? Assuming that it is permissible, is it obligatory again on her to observe proper hijab?
Well, it's not necessary. It's not necessary for a woman to obtain her husband's permission to take pictures. You know, the husband has no authority over his wife when it comes to taking pictures. You know, or you know, she can take pictures using her mobile phone or you know, anyone at any other means.
Right.
See. But Ayatollah Khamenei says that if there is a possibility that non-mahram men might see her pictures and without hijab, and it might lead to some kind of bad deed or evil consequences, then of course it's necessary for her to observe hijab while taking pictures. It's, you know, she might take pictures without hijab, and there, it's very much likely that those pictures might end up falling in the hands of non-mahram men or strangers. And those pictures are also very much likely to be misused by those people. And, of course, such incidents have taken place, you know, many times over. So it's very much necessary to exercise precaution when it comes to taking pictures with or without hijab. And you should make sure to protect your album and not to let your pictures fall in the hands of other people, in order to make sure that those pictures are not, you know, misused or getting circulated on the internet, on the cyberspace. That's it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Sheikh Javid. Thank you very much for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun La ilaha illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.